Stuttering. Why does it happen? Why does one person in a family stutter and no one else does? Or why does a person stutter while speaking but not while singing? Stuttering is largely a mystery, one that researchers at Michigan State University are trying to unravel. J. Scott Yeras is a professor and clinical speech-language pathologist at Michigan State, and Karen Herring is a doctoral student who is part of this stuttering research, and she lives with a stutter. Scott, do we know what causes stuttering?
It's an excellent question. The answer is yes and no. Yes, we know that stuttering starts in the brain. We can identify differences in the brains between people who stutter and people who don't. But we still don't know how those brain differences lead to the specific behavior that's unique to stuttering, that moment of being stuck when you're moving forward in your speech.
So what it is not an emotional disorder. It is not a habit. So old ideas of stuttering don't hold.
That's correct. We struggle with this quite a bit today because even though stuttering is not a psychological problem, it can certainly have psychological consequences for people. And often people confuse the two and think that people who stutter must have an emotional problem when in fact that's not the case.
Now, I know you're doing the largest survey ever of people who stutter. Tell us about that. How many people have you surveyed and what questions are you trying to answer?
What we're trying to understand more is about what it's like to actually be a person who stutters. Interestingly enough, our field has relied primarily on the judgments of listeners, speech therapists, parents, teachers, in determining what stuttering is. And what we're trying to do is shift the focus back to people who actually live with stuttering, people who are coping with this on a daily basis, to get their input about what they experience, what the moment of stuttering is, and how it affects their lives. We have over 600 people so far who've responded to this survey, and believe it or not, that is the largest one ever conducted in our field. And we believe that we're learning some unique lessons from asking people about their daily experiences.
And to that point of getting the perspective of someone who understands and is a speaker who stutters, not a listener listening to someone, we have Karen Herring, who is a doctoral student involved in this research. Karen, good to have you with us. When do you first remember being aware that you were stuttering?
I first remember stuttering when I was 8, so I was in the 3rd grade, and I just remember it coming on really, really fast. I can remember times in my life where stuttering was not a part of my speech, and then just going into school and having to read aloud in class and all of a sudden not being able to get any words out. And just being really, really confused by that and frustrated and just really lost, not understanding. I knew what I wanted to say and just not being able to get any sounds out.
Especially looking back with the hindsight of being someone who's now in the field, what do you think went on?
I wish that I knew. I don't really know what sparked it. I do know that stuttering is in my genes. My grandfather stutters too. So it was something probably always within me that for some reason decided to come out.
That is fascinating. How did your parents react?
My parents were pretty confused at first too. I think they sort of always thought of stuttering as being this stereotypical repetitions in speech. And when I started stuttering, I was having these very long blocks where it was just really, really tense and there was no sound. It almost looked like I just forgot what I was trying to say or didn't know what the next word was because I wasn't able to get out any sound. So I don't think they really knew what to do at first. They brought me to a speech therapist at that point. And unfortunately, there's a lot of speech pathologists in our field that aren't comfortable working with stuttering. And she also didn't really know what to do. I was just having a really hard time and no one really knew what was going on.
Scott, are there different types of stuttering?
Yes, there are. The word stuttering is used to refer to a group of different kinds of conditions that involve disrupted speech. The kind that we do the most research on is, as Karen was describing, typically starts in childhood, may start suddenly, but may have a more gradual onset, typically is associated with some type of family history, because we know there's a genetic component in many cases. It's not clear that it's all cases. That's the kind that receives the most study. But there are other conditions that are also called stuttering that involve disrupted speech, but they're a little bit different.
Such as?
One is known as neurogenic stuttering, or stuttering associated with some type of clear neurological event, like a head trauma or a stroke. Sometimes after those neurological insults, people will demonstrate behaviors that look like stuttering, though we believe that that is a different condition than the stuttering that typically starts in childhood. It's technically called childhood onset fluency disorder. That's general stuttering. Another kind is following a psychological trauma. It's quite rare, but some people will show stuttering behaviors following an emotional event of some sort. Again, it sounds different, but it does still involve a disruption in speech.
I'm thinking, Scott, of a couple of cases that people would be probably familiar with. First of all, the late country singer Mel Tillis, who stuttered through his whole life when he spoke, yet sang without the trace of a stutter. And I'm also thinking of the film The King's Speech. And in that, we saw how King George stopped speaking with a stutter when headphones were put on and music was played as he spoke. What do you think is going on with those kinds of examples?
Yes, you've highlighted two of the very interesting phenomena associated with stuttering. Stuttering is not a constant behavior. One of the challenges of studying stuttering is that it varies so much. And there are these interesting conditions under which stuttering is often, not always, but often diminished. Singing is one. Many people who stutter when they sing, they'll be more fluent. Not all. I know people who stutter when they sing, but many will experience increased fluency, in part because the organization of the brain for singing is different. You're using, of course, the same muscles, but you're using them in a different way. And the same is true if you remember the classic scene in The King's Speech, mm-hmm. when he's swearing, you know, and he's releasing emotion in different ways. We do see this temporary fluency. Unfortunately, from the perspective of a speech-language pathologist, those don't make good therapy approaches. We can't encourage our clients to sing their words or to swear their words, but speaking under a loud noise, speaking under what we call delayed auditory feedback, that is where you hear your voice delayed a little bit, these contribute temporary fluency. And it's interesting because they lead some people down a path of thinking, oh, I've found a cure, I've found a treatment here. But it's all temporary and artificial, unfortunately. It doesn't normalize the brain. It just contributes what we often call artificial fluency.
What do you want to be able to do with this research, this all this data that you're gathering as you're going around and you've gotten, as you say, the largest amount of folks that can answer your surveys about what it is like to stutter? What can you do with this information?
We have two primary goals. One is, as Karen mentioned, there's many speech-language pathologists in our field who aren't comfortable working with those who stutter. And one of the reasons for that is that they don't have sufficient understanding of stuttering. Our hope is to be able to bring this data that we've got to help speech-language pathologists better understand stuttering and therefore provide better treatment. So that's a clinical goal, if you will. Mm-hmm. Our scientific goal is to better understand what that moment of disruption is like by getting the input from a wide range of people who experience this moment differently. There's no two people who describe exactly the same experience of stuttering. And our hope is that by better understanding the breadth of the experience of stuttering, we'll be able to relate that to some of our other studies, studies looking at the underlying neurology of stuttering, studies looking at the genetics of stuttering, to say this is why we see such variety of experience in the lives of people who stutter. That, again, will fold back to improving our treatment, but it will also help us with identifying the underlying markers that lead to a risk for developing stuttering in the first place.
What drew you to this work, Scott?
For me, just luck. My background is in linguistics and in psychology, and my interest is in studying not only communication and language, but studying how people interact with one another. And stuttering intersects with those issues quite directly. It's about the human experience. It's about language formulation. It's about communication. And it's about trying to cope with a stigmatized difference. People who stutter are different in ways that society has difficulty accepting. And the psychologist in me wants to help with that. The linguist in me wants to understand that.
Karen, you are in this field, doctoral student. You're working away at this. What do you want to do in your career? And how will the fact that you have stuttered since you were a child inform that work?
The fact that I stutter is definitely what drove me to be in this field. I was interested in sort of stuttering and understanding it since I was young, because so many of the questions that I had, the speech pathologist that I saw didn't know. And that was a frustrating thing to me. I just felt like there was so many questions that I had, and it felt like there was so much work to be done. And I was really driven to sort of be involved in that and see what I can find. My main hopes of sort of what I learn and what I find is sort of two-part. I think one is stuttering right now is often judged from the listener's perspective. And we decide if someone's stuttering and when someone's stuttering, how severe their stuttering is, just based on what we can hear. And I think there's so much more than that. And being able to get the perspective of someone who stutters and really understand how and if stuttering impacts their life and impacts their ability to effectively communicate is so much more important to me than how many disfluencies someone has. So figuring out a way to define stuttering and measure stuttering beyond what we can hear.
Talk to, Karen, parents of, say, youngsters who are where you were when you were in third grade and stuttering showed up in your life, unbidden, unannounced, and you join the world of people who stutter. What do you want to say to parents who are trying to figure out how to put this all in place?
That I understand that this is a scary and confusing time. And that this doesn't have to be what defines them. It's fine to sort of mourn and feel some sort of a loss of the once fluent speech that you had and the ease that came with communication. But being a person who stutters doesn't mean that you can't communicate effectively or get a good job or have a family or have a successful life. And that stuttering doesn't have to hold anyone back from doing any of those things. Sometimes it's a little bit more difficult, but that in the end, their child will be fine.
Well, and people can get their PhDs, can't they, Karen?
Yeah.
Karen Herring is a doctoral student, and Scott Yarros is a professor and clinical speech language pathologist at Michigan State University, where they're doing groundbreaking research on stuttering. Thank you so much to both of you for sharing your work with us. It has really been great to learn about it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.